The Koi Gig Pod on Off the Ball.
When we first started the podcast, I was traumatized, and then things have gotten a little bit better since then. So, we'll go one more year in the peace.
Subscribe to the Koi Gig Pod on the Off the Ball app now.
OTB's The Hurling Pod
with Bord Gáis Energy,
proud sponsors of the Senior Hurling Championship.
You are very welcome along. It is the second episode of season 3 of The Hurling Pod. Two episodes in, we've had to change the format ever so slightly. Because if you're listening last week, Paul Murphy's away. He's currently skiing somewhere in Austria, we believe, making sure he doesn't get injured ahead of the new season. But it means that James Gale and I are here with you. We're going to take a look back on what was an absorbing All-Ireland Club Hurling final. Full of drama, twists and turns, eventually ending with St Thomas's picking up the Tommy Moore at Croke Park for the second time and their first success since 2013. We'll take a look at all the rest of the hurling news. We're not going to have a conclusion now to the Munster Hurling League. Just before recording, we found out from Munster Council there just won't be space in the calendar for the two matches to be completed out, Cork against Limerick and the final between Waterford and the winners of that game. We do know we're going to have a Walsh Cup final this coming Sunday afternoon. It's going to be in Carlow, which will be Galway against Wexford. If you're listening to us on Monday, or listen to this is your free pod, which you can pick up every week free of charge. We're going to give you the next 35 minutes or so. And if you want a more in-depth conversation where we're going to look at a few other topics along the way, join us from Thursday morning if you're an audio listener, or if you want to pick it up in video on Thursday afternoon, which will be the pod for OTB members. All the information, if you want to become a member and pick up all of Off the Ball's content, it is available offtheball.com/join. James Gale, how are you?
I'm very well, Will. I feel a small bit abandoned by Paul.
I think we're both too.
But in typical public service fashion, they take a holiday every 6 weeks. So what can we do?
Well, he said he burned most of his holidays in the first half of last year. So let's see if maybe he can push back some of his holidays and stay with us most weeks. So unable to join us. To be fair to him, when he was on his, I think, 15th honeymoon last year, he brought the iPad to Africa on safari with him and did a show. And I kind of felt a little bit bad for him for doing that. So he's maybe earned this 1 week break.
Don't feel sorry for him. I was mocking him and saying he's one wife in 15 honeymoons. Like, who else does that? You know, we're lucky to get one honeymoon at all.
Oh. Well, but Paul, it might have been 15, but it was definitely at least 4 honeymoons that he took. First one was delayed by COVID, so he made the most of it in terms of holidays. So you're surviving, batting down the hatches with the storm at the moment in Galway as well, Skell, are you?
Yeah, so look, come here. If I'm coming and going a small bit, please forgive me because the Wi-Fi in Capitagal is questionable in the month of June. So add in an old storm there and matters may get a bit worse. So, but we plough on and see how things go.
Well, look, make any joke you want about brewing up a storm at Croke Park. I mean, what a All-Ireland final we had. I'll play a clip of the last minute of drama as called by Galway Bay now in a second. But just in a general sense, there was something a little bit old school about the fact that it was 18 points to 17. There were mistakes because of the weather, because of the wind. There was hooking, there was blocking, there was physical play out there. It wasn't the score fest that maybe we've seen in the last few seasons. But as good a final as you could hope to see, really.
Yeah, I think what everyone wanted was just was a general, you know, toe-to-toe battle. Like, for me, when systems get involved in hurling, and sometimes even the media or ourselves or people or, you know, spectators get more bogged down about the systems that are involved as opposed to the actual spectacle. But Thomas's and Lachlan's, they just went toe-to-toe. That's what they did. And despite the weather, which obviously watching from a television perspective, you think the weather is better than it is. But when the close-ups began, you could see that it was torrential rain, horrible wind. So to produce the spectacle they did, it actually probably added to it. The weather probably added to the spectacle because it created more drama. You then appreciated some of the outrageous skill, like Aina Burke. Everyone will rightfully talk about that last point he got, which is the second best score I've ever seen in Croke Park. But even the point he got before that, where he swiveled anti-clockwise and over the shoulder. Like, people won't talk about that one. But that one itself was ridiculous, because even the passage of play where There was loads of tackles, but David came in just prior to Aina taking that shot and pummeled some lad. I think a Lachlan Gales midfielder from there pummeled it. Aina gets the ball, swivels over the bar. You know, it was just awesome. And like, the game wasn't without its drama. Obviously, we cover this, and I had said last week that I just hope the two teams go at it, and we don't have any deciding factors from external factors. But in typical fashion, we're going to have to talk about the officials.
We are.
So here we are. Here we are.
We've got red cards that weren't given to be discussed. We've the red card that was given to be discussed. We've got a player getting pushed almost into Hill 16 and no action taken. We've had a goal scored at the Hill 16 end, which wasn't given. And we'll hear from Fintan Burke in a moment about the fact that he knew he had carried the ball over the line himself and he knew he kind of got away with one slightly there. The umpire's position in it. They left us with plenty of talking points coming out of the game. The Ada Burke one is interesting because I'm going to play the audio of his score now in a second. But before we do, you raised the point that he had scored a wonderful point kind of over his shoulder that he snapped over the bar just a few moments before that. Mm-hmm. And he actually said after the game, because I was listening to him on Galway Bay, he said that effectively that gave him the confidence to go for the one on the sideline. Because realistically, you're talking about percentage plays when the ball is up in that area, 64th minute of the game, in the melting pot, you're probably thinking retain possession and try and work it back for another score. But he somehow juggles the ball into his hand. And despite the fact that there's three defenders converging around him, it's the most perfect first-time shot where he had to be shooting blind as well.
And like everything worked, as you said, you used the word there, perfect, and you took the word completely out of my mouth. Everything worked perfectly. First of all, to get the ball in his hand under such duress that he was with people around him, on the sideline, turns, strikes off the left, which is his weaker side, and then she curls in lovely. Like, I was just thinking in real time, I was excited with him. I was thinking in real time after, if I gave him the ball, and I said, right, Aina, there's nobody here around you, put the ball over the bar from there. It'd be hard enough to do that. It'd be hard enough to do it from that angle in that weather, you know, with the pressure of someone asking you to do it. But then you introduce all the factors of lads everywhere, game on the line, time is up, you know, weather is horrendous, off your weak side, like shooting from the 21. Like, it was awesome. And the fact of the matter is, like, if you know Aina Burke, he's, I would call, a shoot-on-sight merchant. You never associate him with getting in ruck ball or fielding very high ball or being a puck-out target. No, his forte is getting that kind of ball out in the fringes of the rucks, being kind of an out ball for the lads who go in and win. Normally his brother, Dara or David, who go in and get the ball, give it to him, and then he comes up with the goods. And like, come here, utilise your players. I remember asking Brian Henley, if you remember, he played for Athlone Rye back in the 90s.
Yeah.
On 20 manager last year. I said, how were you so good back then? And the answer he gave me back then was just that we all knew our roles perfectly. We all stayed within our roles. So he wasn't taking on the shots that Eugene Clunan would take on. And Eugene Clunan wasn't doing the work that Brian Henley was doing. So it just kind of reminds me of Aina Burke. You won't, as I said to you, you won't see him in the rucks, but you'll see him shooting. So put your best shooters in the best in position to take the shots. And that's exactly what happened. So kudos to him. But I was laughing. We're going through the incidents after the game, trying to pick out the big moments. And obviously, he got yellow card for trying to deter. We call Mikey Butler's run in the first half.
He could well have got a second yellow early in the second half, and that's a different story.
This is the thing: if that yellow wasn't given to Aina in the first half, and he commits the same foul like he did in the second half, that's yellow card. You know, that's a slap. And like, we associate that with yellow card all the time. And the thing is, if he got yellow card for the slap as his first yellow card, there would be no complaints, I'd imagine, from anybody in Thomas's bench or camp. But it feels to me that Sean Stack just took the game in his own hands. Said, you know what? He was putting context on the game where a ref shouldn't be, in my view. So, like, there was luck on both sides, if you ask me, and misfortune. Like, but the trouble is, the misfortune was outweighed heavily against O'Loughlin's, I'm afraid.
Right. We'll hear Sean Walsh and Cyril Farrell calling the winning score and the free that went just wide from Mark Bergen now in a sec. But you mentioned there it was the second best score he'd ever seen. Joe Canning, I'm assuming, is first, is it?
The Swivel goal against Kilkenny in the final.
Well, I was thinking maybe it was the one against Tipperary when we were thinking of last gasp. But
context, you're dead right. That was a super score, but that was a static strike under the Cusack. But I'm thinking of the one where, if you remember, Andy Smith hitting the ball and Joe had to he had to swivel in a 360, catch the ball, and in the same motion, put a pass on Murphy. That for me was the best score I've ever seen in Croke Park. I'm sure the listeners will put in plenty more types. I remember there was a score, I can't remember who got it for Wexford back in the early 2000s with a double. It was brilliant. I can't remember, but for me, Canning was number one, and Aina has now put himself in position for number two.
Yeah, I mean, the Canning goal against Kilkenny is remarkable, because you say he does it in one kind of fluid movement. So he obviously has spotted the position where he wants to be in when the ball comes through. So we played it to him last year at the live show. It comes over his shoulder and he knows exactly his technique once it comes over his shoulder as well. Oftentimes a player would maybe be checking or maybe trying to switch back onto the other side. It was like Canning knew when that ball was in the breadbasket into his hand exactly what he was going to do with it. And almost impossible to defend if a player can swivel and shoot with such accuracy as well.
Well, like, I think what he was as well, Will, all good points, but I think what he was he was devoid of options. So the way he had, in order to catch the ball in air, you know, from physically to see it, he had to swivel. And as he was swiveling, I think he nearly kind of half lost his footing or lost his balance. So he had no option but to fall and strike in the singular motion. And that makes the degree of difficulty extremely, extremely hard. And then when you add in the other factors of the opposition, the goalkeeper you're going against, you know, and just the general, I suppose, execution as a whole, it was top drawer, really and truly,
so,
you know.
So basically what you're saying is if he had blazed that into Hill 16 and mishit it, you wouldn't have exactly blamed him for that happening.
Well, come here, if you pick 100 hurlers across the country and ask them to do it, I'd say 99 can't. You know what I mean? So like it's a very specific skill to be executed by a very specific level of hurler. So yeah. I think there's not even a handful that can do it, to be honest, Will.
Well, like at full time yesterday, I was kind of sticking down ones that I had thought of that were just like remarkable. I was thinking more in terms of winners or decisive scores, because it wasn't the last puck of the game, because obviously we had the free that happened less than a minute later and that had its own drama to the game as well. But I was thinking of Canning in the semi-final against Tipperary, just that kind of clutch moment where you know it's going to be that one chance. You might not get another one and he sticks it over. Harry Ruddle came to mind as well, the All-Ireland final from a couple of years ago, where it looks like Ballyhale Shamrocks are about to go through and be crowned champions and you've got this one shot at it and he puts it in the net. It's the only way they could have won that game and he produced the strike. And I was thinking of Michael Jacob in the Leinster final for Wexford against Kilkenny as well, where it didn't give Kilkenny enough time to actually react and come back afterwards. So I think Aidan Burke's right up there with all of them.
Was Michael Jacob the one where he blocked down and stuck it in the net, was it?
Yeah. And it was like literally last gasp.
Yeah. Yeah, I hate to be on the receiving end of those ones, but like I suppose what you're doing is it can be done. You're putting the context of the game and like maybe a momentous occasion, you know, in place as well, which I suppose the score carries far more weight. Whereas I'm probably looking at it solely from an execution perspective and level of difficulty, and even that's why Aina Burks is double sided. It's A, it's the last gasp winner, and B, it's extremely difficult to execute. So. Like when you put it that way, should I even put it number one then?
That's for you to rank. I was trying to just write them down because I'd written down a few football ones while you're thinking about like Seamus Darby probably being the most famous of them. Because again, you take the aspect of a bit like the Ballyhale Shamrocks one against Ballygunner, where Kerry are on the cusp of history and then the game is taken from them by this dramatic moment where somebody puts the ball into the net. And ironically, a lot of these scores seem to be coming on that Hill 16 side as opposed to down the other end. But here is Aina Burke's goal, the commentary of it, because I really love the excitement around this. This is Galway Bay's commentary of St. Thomas's point, which put them in front, but also them surviving, giving away a free, which looked like it was about to send it to extra time.
It breaks. Can Thomas get a score? Tony Farrington looks like he has it. The man that really has it in his hand, though, is Jamie Finnerty. He's under pressure. He's been forced out to the Hawkins outside the feet. Aina Burke picks it up. He's been put under pressure. Aina Burke swiveling off the left. Aina Burke into the 20-metre line. What a score!
Great score.
He's going to win it on Ireland.
Score.
What a score! Aina Burke swiveling, losing his balance even. What a score! Aina Burke over the bar. It's a score worthy of winning in All-Ireland. 18-17. We played 6-3. First we won on the clock. The ball hits the deck. David Burke was around there, but also there's Sean Booker. His foul is going to be a free for Loughlin Gales. We played the 4 minutes. 18 points for St. Thomas's. 17 points for Loughlin Gales.
There's pressure on. Pressure on Mark Bergen now. Out a long ways. Definitely on the midfield, Mark. And he's out near the sideline. David Burke is trying to get him out further, but like, you know, this is going to come in around the house. He'll go for the score if he's able to get it. Now there's a fair breeze against him.
Yeah, Mark Bergen.
And look at the shoe Lawler's got into the pocket, lads. Is he going to go to him?
But Mark Bergen, 16 years ago, he was playing the All-Ireland Club, the All-Ireland Post-Primary Schools final. He had a free to equalise for Kilkenny CBS against De La Salle. He missed it, hit the post at this very end of the field. Mark Bergen striking the free. It's on its way. It's gone to the left-hand side and wide. St. Thomas's are on the verge of All-Ireland final. St. Thomas's are the champions. 18 points for the champions of Galway. 17 points for the champions of Loughlin Gales. St. Thomas's have got back to the Holy Grail. In 2013 they won the All-Ireland Club title, but in the year 2024 they have finally got their hands on the Tommy Moore Cup for the second time.
Yeah, the commentary there coming from Sean Walsh and from Cyril Farrell on Galway Bay yesterday afternoon. And like they brought up in the commentary there, and Mark Bergner brought up himself ahead of the Leinster final, we said he was going back to Croke Park and he felt like maybe he'd left some of those ghosts behind him by scoring the winning score against Nafina that day as well. But, you know, it's a horrible way for a free taker, you know, to have gone back. He was also pucking into the Canal End that day back in the post-primary schools final over a decade ago. For him to suppose have to face up to that again, a very difficult free to have to take, swirling wind, difficult conditions yesterday, and it was a long, long way out, like effectively on the halfway line.
Oh, it's extremely difficult, and it's easy for us to say on the television, like in terms of distance and angle, it said this should be an easy enough one, but it's not. Like you can imagine what it's like for his hands, his body, the grip of the hurl, the slither, everything is just, you know, it's extremely hard because of the conditions, obviously. And then you add in, you know, the weight of the free. And like, I don't think, to be honest, Will, he would have thought back to that free back when he was in school. He has probably struck thousands and thousands of frees at this stage. So I don't know where his mind gone back to that. I'm 99.9% sure he would have been in the moment. But look, it's terribly heartbreaking. And look, that is the beauty and that's the cruelty of sport, where we're praising Enid Burke for pulling off a wonder shot. Like, obviously, Mark Bergen will look at himself this morning and say, God, if only I got that point. But that wasn't the be-all, end-all of the game, to be honest. And I think he'll know that himself. And I'm sure the people of Loughlin Gaels will, you know, I won't say console him, but reassure him that so much more happened in the game that, yes, it came down to the free. And it's easy for the public to say that if that free went over, you know, you'd have a different outcome. But fact of the matter is, Loughlin Gaels as a whole in the second half, the whole team have to look at themselves, I think, to be honest. Because especially when James Regan gets sent off, to go and then get beaten, to lose a 2-point lead and then get a man sent off, and then, you know, I have to say, capitulate, Will. They just didn't get enough from the forwards as a whole. As a whole, they didn't get enough from the forwards. Like, I was just going through a statistics there whereby obviously Thomas has scored 18 points. They got 13 from play, and that's excellent great shooting, you could say, from a play perspective. 17 points were came for Loughlin's, and you say 14 came from play. Not so bad, you'd say, but 8 of those came from their backs. You know, 8 of those came from people who were playing from 1 to 7, and that just kind of signifies they won't get enough return from their forwards, whereas Thomas's were. Even the shots that Thomas's took, they had 10 wides, which were 10 from play, whereas the Loughlin's had 7 wides and only 3 from play, you know. So it screamed to me that maybe they were lacking just one person, maybe lacking the, I would say, the Enid Burke type person who can shoot on sight, because they obviously have, you know, Mark Bergen, and they have the big number 12, as I was calling him, is it Neary? Heary, should I say.
Yeah, Heary's been very good. I think he's got a good chance of playing for Kilkenny this year. He's been very good.
Yeah, impactful, effective, can mix it, can survive in there, like as we've seen. But they just didn't have the finishers, you know, whereas Thomas has had Connor, they had James Regan for a period, obviously, they had Enid Burke, you know, and then you add in kind of the workhorses, you could say, with the Darrers and these people, and then complemented by David. So it just seemed like the Thomas has had a better balance. And I think when we were talking last week online, we were saying it'll come down to the Thomas forwards versus the excellent Loughlin Gaels backs. And to be fair, the Thomas forwards, you know, even with a man down, even with only 5 guys in their forward line, they completely turned over Loughlin's. They didn't allow them any platform to come out with the ball. And there's numerous occasions I can pick whereby a ball goes into the hillside in one of the corners and there's just relentless pressure from Thomas's. Every time Loughlin's get the ball, there's 2 or 3. And that's what they're renowned for in Galway specifically, is that they're in a terribly hard nut to crack. You couldn't say that they're the most unbelievable, skillful set of forwards, that they'd light you. They just, on days they can, but they're an exceptional unit whereby it's very hard to come out with the ball. It's very hard to win their puck out. You know, it's very hard to run through them. And then when they run at you, it's very hard to stop them. So they seem to have an awful lot of facets to their game that if you can block off one, they come up with another. And like, when we play them, it's a question of matchups. Like, okay, if we take care of Connor and Aina, well then up pops David and James Regan. Another day you take care of James Regan and David, and then Connor and Aina pop up. It's very hard to match them all, obviously. And that's why people have done with Ballyhale over the years. You know, it's very hard to match up against the whole lot of them. Whether it be, you know, Owen Cody, TG Reid, Colin Finlay, etc., AJ Mullen. So, but yesterday, I think, was probably their finest hour ever. Their best performance in 30 minutes of hurling in the second half when everything was against them and they came up through it. That's definitely the, I suppose, I'd say best performance, but I definitely the most workmanlike and the most satisfying, and to do it on the biggest day, so complimentary, kudos to them.
Yeah, and I think a switch they made probably helped quite a bit as well, which was pushing Conor Cooney in closer to goal in the second half, because they tried to use pace against Hugh Lawler in the first half, and maybe there would have been a temptation to stick with that because Hugh Lawler was on a yellow card, and you're thinking when you're playing with the wind, maybe you try and get him running around, drag him into awkward places. But bringing in Conor Cooney to go up against him and to occupy him actually worked very well in the second half, especially when you consider St. Thomas has spent most of that half hour having to deal with being a man short.
Yeah, like in the first half, they said there were six balls that went in contested with Hugh Lawler and Oisin Flannery, Victor Manzo, and Hugh Lawler blocked down, made five blocks in the first half. So because he's so pacey and rangy, you know, for a big man, it's very surprising how fast he is, that the smaller guys that Thomas's have, that try to exploit him in space, they couldn't get around him. So that means that they negate you. That means you automatically negated your ball to space, and you negated your high ball because Lawler's obviously going to win the high ball. So they changed tactic, obviously, and then they put in Conor Cooney, and that way then they could go more route one. So Conor Cooney is very, very good at lateral runs. So you would never have a case whereby Hugh Lawler would be in front of Conor, because Conor's so good at moving, he'll always be there on first arrival. But then you'll have a situation whereby you can lump the ball to a degree, you know, down on top of Conor as well, because everyone knows he can contest high ball there. So that little change can have a monumental shift on the game. That's exactly, like, that's just one nugget of it, okay? And then you have to say that Shane Cooney came into the forward in the second half, centre back, who was excellent. David Burke was tremendous. Like, he hit everything that moved, ball and men. So he was fabulous. And in what I was saying before last week in the Ballygunner game, like, he was like the director general, whereby he was telling everyone to go. And again, it was evident yesterday. Now, I wasn't at the game yesterday, but you could see on the television, he was still, you know, liaising with everyone in his half back line, half forward, etc., and keeping things organised and showing the road, even in the face of adversity when they got a man sent off, wrongly sent off, in my view. We'll cover that in a moment. But they just seem to gel perfectly. And, you know, there's probably, it's hard to describe this, Will, but probably in-game, whereby, yes, James Regan gets sent off and you're sent yourself right, this is going to be game over. It's kind of, let's knuckle down, go at it hard and see what happens. And they just clawed their way back into the game. And the minute they drew level and then came a point in front, you could see that they rose and they said, this can actually be done. So once that little bit of belief got restored back into them, because I would say surely it got taken away from them when the red card was flashed, but once it got restored, it was just a case of, we're in the fight. And if you get involved in a fight with Thomas's, you know, you're not going to win. I'm afraid to say that. There's numerous clubs in Galway that have tried that in Galway. It doesn't work.
Yeah, well, I think Ballygunner saw that back in Portlaoise in December in the semi-final as well. Like, they're a very hard team to go up against physically. When they impose their game on you, they're incredibly effective at doing that.
Yeah, they're hugely effective, Will. And the thing about it is, like, you'd look at them and say you're not blessed with blistering pace or blistering energy. They don't need it because they're systematically so good that they draw you into a good fight. And if you want, like, as I said to you, it's very hard to get through them. So it's hard to run through them. So you have to kind of go around them. And when they get the ball in, they go through you. It's that simple. And, like, but they're, and it's easy to say that you look at Finchin and Shane Cooney and Dave Burke and Connor, you look at the bigger guys. But these lads are well able to hurl. Like, I think Finton could play on, you know, five lines of the field. So could David. Darragh Burke has proven that in the past. You know, as Aina Burke has played in, you know, half back line, midfield, half forward line. So they're quite a balanced team in terms of their skill set, whereby they can operate universally, if you know what I mean. Mm. And they're not pigeonholed into a corner forward role. So obviously, people have their roles in that team. Same with the backs, but they have this supreme balance that they can turn into a dogfight. And Ballygunner, I think, hadn't, I suppose, come up against that in a good while. Everyone tried to take them on an open game to go around them, but Thomas wanted to go through them. And when they pull them down, I don't mean to be disrespectful to say to a level, but when you pull them into kind of a dogfight and arm wrestle, that suits Thomas down to the ground lovely. So if you get into an arm wrestle, they'll arm wrestle you out of it. And as I said to you before, they've won eight counter titles in, I'm going to say,
it's
11
2012.
Years.
Yeah.
Yeah. So 11 years, like, so they've won 8 out of 11. And a lot, how many battles have they gone through? With the nucleus of this team being the same team for 11 years, how many battles have they gone through and arm wrestled? Loads. So if you get involved with an arm wrestle with them, not going to happen. And if O'Loughlin Gales, again, it's ifs and buts, but I have to point to their forward unit and say they just didn't get enough out of them, and they'll rue that.
Yeah, because we were kind of meshing away in WhatsApp while the game was on, and you were saying, like, how many of the halfbacks were on the scoreboard in the first half? All three of them had scored, and it was like Paddy Deegan was getting exactly what he wanted. He was getting on front football with the wind, and he was getting that bit of space, and he was happy to keep going forward and getting scores himself or setting up scores for others. St. Thomas's probably did a better job of keeping a handle on them in the second half. But of course, the other side of the story is you can't be relying on your backs coming up to get those scores, because they will dry up, particularly against the wind.
Hugely. And the thing is, I suppose, Loughlin's did very well. I was impressed from the first half because they managed to avoid the contact, mostly with Thomas's. So avoid physical contact, avoid rooks, you know, avoid having to get in situations where it's like 4-on-4 in close proximity. And they were able to shift the ball across the field, open the field and shoot from long range. That was really good, really impressive. But when the conditions go against you, you know, you can't do that. You can't shoot from 70 yards in Croke Park, you know, with the breeze and wind in your face, because it's too much of a difficulty with distance, etc. So that kind of facet of your game, that element of your game gets negated. Now you have to move the ball further and depend on people further up the pitch. So your half-back line can't go off up past your midfield into your half-forward line and do the scoring for you. You have to shift the ball up quick, because you're running into numbers if you start running the ball from the back in that type of game. So that's what happened. Numerous balls went into the Loughlin's forwards, and they just couldn't come out of them. Their retention rate in the second half was very poor. I thought, I'd say, when the balls went into the 13, 14, 15, they couldn't hold the ball, they couldn't recycle it, and then some of their shooting choices, I'd have to say, static shooting, which they'll be disgusted with, again, just it didn't come off of them. So if you look at the statistics throughout the whole championship, in the Kilkenny Championship, their half-back line has been their launch pad, their main platform for scores, their highest scoring line, you could say. And so when the conditions come in play, mix it with the dogs that's in St. Thomas's, you know, and that line gets negated for a period, it turned the whole game. And look at the influence that Conor Cooney and Darragh Burke have, you know, physically, that they can, those two guys could, you know, basically take on three, if not four, Loughlin Gael's backs. So look at the job that them forwards did, and provide opportunities for the shooters then, versus the Loughlin's forwards. Big difference.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where you look back, you wonder if some of the warning signs were there at different stages during the championship as well, because I saw them in the Leinster semi-final against Kilcormac-Killoughy, and a bit like that, they were hugely on the ball in the first half of that game, left 9 or 10 scorers behind them, and you're wondering, is this going to leave the door open for the opposition to come back in? And on that day, Kilcormac-Killoughy did reduce the score back, and then there was a bit of a finishing flurry from O'Loughlin Gales, but still the game was down to 3 points with a few minutes to go, and you're wondering how a team that did so much hurling in the first half could have ever ended up in trouble during the game. But the reality was that they weren't able to push on. I think that, again, that was a big issue on Sunday afternoon at Croke Park, which was, got themselves into an okay position at halftime. You're thinking, once you've got that extra man momentum as well, there should really only be one winner from that point. But actually, it was St. Thomas's who did a tremendous amount of the hurling a man short in the second half. So that's what happens for Loughlin Gales if you leave a team in it in those circumstances. The red card itself, you've already kind of hinted your feeling on it, where you said you don't think it was a fair red card. So James Regan comes in. I think the contact, it's fair to say, is pretty minimal. But I could probably understand on the first replay why the officials thought that maybe the hit was a bit higher and harder than it was. But when you see it on the replay, this looks like a very harsh red card, doesn't it?
Yeah, look, from playing the game, right, which is very important to note that now, when you're playing the game, you know the degree of impact you actually absorb, okay? Now, so I have to explain myself here. When I saw it real time, I said, get up, I said. You know, because I saw the amount of impact that happened, right? And I knew well that I can't remember the guy's name who went down, but
was that because the arms had gone up and the fact that he kind of thrown himself forward after the contact?
Yeah, so
is that what you're thinking?
Yeah, because of course, I don't know how else to describe it. Will, he flopped, you know what I mean? And it was theatrics. That's just being honest, right? And if he got a full elbow on the head, his body goes down way more, and you can see you'll see the level of force that he absorbs is at a much different level than what he actually absorbed. So I think he kind of, I have to say, he sold the referee a bit, Will. He sold the referee. And Sean Stack, let's say, he bought it. You know, he bought it. Your man tried to sell it, and Sean Stack bought it. And I thought in real time, looking at it, there's no way he'd give him a red card for this. If you go by the letter of the law, right, which people will argue, oh, it's a red card. Fine, if that's a red card, there should be red cards all over the place. There should have been red cards all over the place if you go by the letter of the law. Technically speaking, there was a headbutt. Technically speaking, there was a striking action with the hurl. Technically speaking, there was a fronting challenge to the head. So when you start going through all these,
would you have given red cards for any of them? Because there's a butting of helmets there. There's, you know, it's obviously a push of a hurl, which you probably see 100 times during a game. To me, none of them really look like red card offences, but they probably would be if you were handing them out maybe harshly, say.
Yeah, I understand what people will say. They'll go to the rule book and they'll say, this is a red card offence. I hear you. But you have to understand, when you come from a position of playing the game, there's a level of force or a level of injury put on your opponent whereby that's either dangerous, you know, really, really dangerous or potentially very dangerous. So the headbutt, I put in, you know, kind of vertical commas, right? Mm. There was no force in that. It was just kind of a little dunt, like a nod, you could say. There's no force in it. The striking from Aina, no force. The shoulder to the chest that Conor Cooney took, yes, that was a hard force. But again, I don't think he got physically really hurt to warrant a red card. So the same thing applies with James Regan. Like when he comes in for the challenge, it's a missed time, yes. And when you slow everything down on replay, which we had the benefit of, referee didn't have it, it looks worse from one angle, but then goes to the other angle, it looks fine. Do you know?
Yeah. So Jack Nolan's the midfielder for Loughlin Gaels is coming through. And I think he feels a bit of contact, but I think when you rewatch it, or as you said there, I think it is a very dramatic fall for the amount of contact that Nolan has taken.
And I truly believe if you asked him himself, you know, did you take much contact? You know, he will tell you no. He'll tell you no. I think the way his momentum was going, that his body was going that direction anyway, and once he got clipped, he just took the legs from under himself and away he goes. So I think, as I said, I think Sean Stack is sold.
Okay. So that's one that seems to have gone against St. Thomas's. One that definitely went against Loughlin Gaels was the goal that wasn't given, which has obviously sparked all the debate. And pretty much every question that we got in on the Instagram was about, should there be goal line technology? Should there be VAR? Surely this shouldn't happen. Well, to talk about the incident first, obviously this is 8 minutes into the game. The ball finds its way to Owen Wall after an initial shot is blocked down. Fintan Burke is going back onto the line in order to try and make the block. He does so successfully, but he carries the ball back in alongside his thigh, I would say a few feet over the line. The one that I didn't understand was why the umpire on the near side ended up going behind the goal as opposed to staying where he was. Because then you would have saw it clearly.
But sure, it's obvious that it's long winded. He was afraid of getting hit.
But you got to stay there.
I've seen for years. But see, okay, we're going back to the umpire discussion here. We had this discussion last year, Will, and I got a bit of flack over it, right? But the officials are there to do a job, and 9 times out of 10, referees pick officials that they are friends. That's fine, because our umpires that are friends, because they're hard to get. Basically, from a calendar perspective, and you know, trying to sequence it with them, you know, for time off, etc. I get all that, right? And a referee likes to keep the same 4 umpires in a general basis, you know, for continuity. I understand that. But their positioning is horrendous. It's the worst position you can take up. You may as well have been standing in the Hill 16, you know, adjudicating as opposed to where their position is. One guy has got to be level on the line. Has to be. And it's always the far side. Whoever's on the far side should be, what I mean by far side, the side that Owen Wall is on, right? That's the side that should be on the line.
So you know, it should be the umpire on the other post.
The side, yes, whatever direction the ball is coming from in a straight line, that's who should be behind the goal. You know what I mean? So he can get clear sight of both posts. Because the guy who's at the front post can't get clear sight, the guy at the back side can get clear sight. So, but both of them, if you watch the body language of both umpires, they're jumping, because they're nearly kind of half afraid to hit with the ball. So it was very, very bad. But even that, I tried to put myself in their position. If I'm behind the goal in their position and I see Finchon carry the ball over in the manner he did, sure, it's obvious it's a goal. the ball was over at least a foot and a half. Yeah. You know, and look, Fintan will be coy enough about it, and rightly so, because he's gone home with the medal now at this stage. But it was a goal. And as I was saying to you, remember last week, we were saying, I hope there's no incidents whereby we start focusing on that as opposed to the game, because ultimately it was a great game. And here we are talking about officials and goals that should have stood. And when that goal didn't go in or wasn't given, I was just praying the Thomases, if they're going to win, they'd win by 4 or 5. Or if Loughlin's win, they win. Do you know what I mean? Fair enough, right? Right. But no, it came down to a singular score. But look, it's a contentious one. The conversation will start, obviously, around technology. If you start into technology, is there need for umpires at all? That's the case. If we have Hawkeye for balls going over the bar and we get some sort of, you know, chips in the balls for under the nets, umpires are gone. What's the use of them? You know, for determining 65s?
Well, on Hawkeye, just because some people, and I know people have tweeted me yesterday going, but how come Hawkeye can't decide if it's not over the line, under the bar, if they're able to make decisions on the trajectory of the ball, if it's going over the bar or not? The reason why is, it's not down to any kind of detection technology within the goalposts themselves or the slitter. The reason I actually found out about this initially was we were doing the old version of the hurling show back and off the ball back in 2019, when Brian Hogan was in goal for Tipperary, and 2 points were given in an All-Ireland semi-final, where Brian had stuck his hurl and his hand up over the bar because he's so tall, he was able to get up there and block 2 shots. They were both registered as scores by Hawkeye on the day, and to this day Brian Hogan is convinced that he did not at any point allow the ball to go all the way over the crossbar. But the way that it was determined, so we were told by some of the Hawkeye officials that we spoke to, is that they've got a series of cameras which are there to essentially map the line of where the ball is going, but it's determining whether the ball is going over the bar and between the posts. And the trajectory is set, because you remember, I think once upon a time they got it wrong where the football settings were on in a hurling game, I think, and they thought the ball had hit the post because it was the football settings. It basically draws a line on Hawkeye like you would see projected for, say, a tennis shot or something like that. So it's based on cameras as opposed to any kind of line detection. What you would need if we were to, say, look at goals like that would be maybe if there's a microchip in the slitter. And sure, they were using the white slitters, not the new yellow smart slitters for the All-Ireland final yesterday anyway. But you would need to probably have the microchip in the ball and then have some kind of goal technology, a bit like the Premier League, where they can decide if the full ball has gone over the bar. So basically, Hawkeye will not be able to do the job that some people were hoping that it would be able to do. Now, apparently, on the screens in the ground, because like you, I was watching it in work yesterday as opposed to being in Croke Park, it was very clear after a couple of replays that TG Carr had shown that the ball had been carried over the line. Apparently, they only showed one or two of those angles on the big screens in the ground, even though I was sure on the match, you could actually hear on the TV covers that people were oohing and aahing within the stadium as if they had seen it on the big screen. So some supporters have said it wasn't as clear as some of the ones that were on TG Carr afterwards. But you mentioned Finn de Burke being coy. He was speaking to Aisling O'Reilly on Off the Ball after the game. This is what he had to say when she asked him about whether he had carried the ball over the line or not.
And I have to ask you about the goal or not a goal in the first half. You fell into the goal, you had it in your hand. Was it over the line?
I, to be honest with you, and I was saying it to the last interview there, I don't know. I'd love to say no, but I don't know. I was back and back behind with the ball in my hand, and I kind of fell in between my legs, and I'd like to think it was on the line, but I suppose we'll have to let the TV lads look at that.
You're pretty happy that you didn't get caught, is what you're saying.
Yeah, very happy, yeah.
The words of a man who says at the end of that clip, you're happy you weren't caught. He knew full well he'd carry that ball over the line.
Jesus, and no better vocal. It's laughable, really, when you think about it. And I was going to ask you a question as you were explaining the Hawkeye situation there and how we're dropping the big screen. If the referee looks at that, Will, right? Because I don't know, has this ever happened before? And he looks at the big screen and he determines that ball's over the line. Can he call that?
The only one that I can think of, the ref isn't meant to be influenced by it, but the only one I can think of is, I remember what do you call him, a fourth official at this stage? You know, the official who's at the side, I think it was a football game a couple of years ago, and the suspicion was that he had brought the referee's attention to something that he had seen on a big screen replay, and therefore said, look, actually, I've just seen it on the screen. I don't think, because you watch the rugby, and so many times in the Champions Cup over the weekend, it's all good through the games on Friday and Saturday, where literally, and even at the sports ground, the ref will just flip around and look at the big screen down on the side, and he'll make his decision based on that. I don't see any reason why, in theory at least, if this could be done, and I know there's different grounds and different rules because there won't be big screens elsewhere, but in the case of it's at Croke Park, I don't see why a referee's attention couldn't be brought to something on the screen for them to make the right call.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't see a reason why we wouldn't have a television on the side with the fourth official or the standby referees, as I said, who can be assessing the screen as the game goes on. The trouble with hurling is the ball shifts, it shifts ground and metres so fast as opposed to rugby or soccer. So you cover, if you look at yesterday, when the ball was cleared, Thomas has been down and scored a point.
It was a 4-point swing, yeah.
Yeah, it didn't drop in the score for Thomas. So the reason I asked the question was, if Thomas has scored that point, can Sean Stack actually go back, remove the point from Thomas's and give the goal to Lachlan's? Is that the rule book? I don't know.
I don't think he can. And I'm happy enough to text one of our referee friends to find out in this one. But I do look back on the Derry against Galway game. Do you remember that one where there was a Hawkeye? It basically broke down. And they went and took a point away at half time as a result. So I don't know. No, I mean,
they actually, what happened was they gave it to Galway after halftime.
That's it. Sorry, they changed the scoreboard at halftime. Yeah,
came out after halftime. The chairman came out, the manager came out, and they put a point on the scoreboard because, like you said, the linesman caught it in real view. So that's where things. That's where officials come together, use their head, and make the correct conscious decision. Whereby I'd love to know. I say it really. I don't know. Has Sean Stack the? I hate to use the word the power to go and take away a score off one team and give it to another team. That would have caused ruptions in hurling.
It would. And that's the exact problem, as you said, because there's natural breaks in other games. Like in the rugby, when I'm thinking of the red cards that were handed at the weekend, at least there's a breakdown in play at that point. So the referee can say, okay, I'll come back for that penalty, or I'll come back for whatever was going to flow from the decision and we'll adjust accordingly. But the ball is dead. In the case of hurling, if you're a goalkeeper, you're probably picking the ball out as quickly as you can. You're pucking it out and there could well be a score in 2 to 3 plays up the other end. We see it happen all the time. Long puck out, someone catches, stick it over the bar. I don't know if at that point they could be like VAR in the Premier League where they could go, actually, I'm going to cancel that score and we're going to go back and take action on what we missed that we've just seen. So I don't know. Look, again, it's open for discussion. Yeah. And I mean, obviously people are now talking about it an awful lot more than they would have been pre-final. And as you say, it's a pity that it became one of the major talking points from what was such an entertaining game of hurling and such an entertaining club season. Like when you consider, well, Auchland Gaels were 1 point better than Ballyhale Shamrocks in the Kilkenny final. The two semi-finals were 1 point games. The All-Ireland final was a 1 point game. All of them could well have gone to extra time and penalties, such as how close they were. So there's been very little difference between the very top teams in the country this year. I want to ask you a little bit about David Burke as well. And a little bit later on, we'll maybe talk about some of the best players you've ever played alongside. But I would think that David is right up there. And, you know, it's 9 months since his knee went. Really and truly, he should have been probably still going through the process of rehab now at the moment. And instead, he's an All-Ireland man of the match in an All-Ireland club final. That is ridiculous going, isn't it?
Ridiculous is a great word. Unbelievable, it gets thrown around too much, but it's scarcely believable that it's actually possible. You know, and I think David, over the whole course of his career, like he doesn't have this major highlight reel. You know, what he is, though, is a complete model of consistency on and off the pitch. You know, even verbally consistent, physically consistent in terms of his preparation, you know, mentally consistent in how strong he is the whole time. And all those facets come together and they culminate in him getting back in, which, to be honest, is a much shorter period than you or I would have expected for him to come back in. And he's a special type of teammate. Now, if I can elaborate on this now, like you said, you have leaders who lead by playing, leaders who lead by, you know, let's say talking, you know, presentations, actions, etc. Then you have the guy in the middle who was able to do both. And I'd say he's one of the few who's able to do both. So he backs up what he says, and he's a very, very good speaker, as you can tell from his interviews, with the way he plays. So like he's been, more often than not, when St. Thomas's have been in trouble in games, like he'll be the primary reason or the primary fixer, the director general they use, and he'll fix things on the pitch in real time, which is very hard to do. It's easy for you, right, to go look at a game, Will, and assess it, analyse it, and go, oh, you went wrong here, thereafter. But to do it in real time is extremely difficult because, yes, you're caught in the moment. If you're in the middle of a game, you're worried about your own fella. You're trying to mark him. You're trying to, you know, obviously assess what the opposition's throwing at you and then reassess your own team as to what you need to do to negate, you know, the opposition's strengths. So he has that kind of skill where he's able to, like, look at that in real time, assess it, and then communicate it to his teammates. And as you can see, more often than not, it works. It works out. And like, yes, they probably look back in time and they'll be obviously delighted with two club titles. They'll probably feel, as David said himself, that he didn't get, you know, that there was a lot of hurt over the last number of years. When you win as many county titles as you do, you'd have hoped to come away with a higher percentage of All-Irelands. But like what he's done over his career, I'm not trying to signal the end of it by any means, but like it's special. And there's very, very few people, probably only a couple or a handful, who have got man of the match in Ireland and in both club and county. I presume a county man of yours has one, Brian Whelan.
Well, Brian Whelan's a ridiculous
beyond
one.
That,
so
it's hard for me to know this.
Yeah, Owen Rigney was asking me on Twitter last night about this because it felt like a very special achievement for David Burke to be man of the match in All-Ireland final for county and for club. Brian Whelan is just one of those guys who kind of is just a statistical anomaly when it comes to most things, Gael. He's done four. two All-Ireland County finals, 94 and 98. 94 was the year he was Hurler of the Year as well, didn't get an All-Star, so he mm-hmm. kind of broke the mould in that one as well and broke a door at the All-Stars in his frustration. But he did two in the 1 year. So in 98, he was the man of the match in the All-Ireland club final and then went on to be man of the match when he was sick in the final against Kilkenny, got pushed up into the forwards. So he did that one. And then he did another club man of the match in 2002 as well. I think the feeling in the club would be he was probably unlucky not to get man the match in the 95 replay as well. So four is not bad.
Not bad. that's putting it lightly, Will, I think. Look, come here, if you or I go ahead and we get a man of the match in a club final, any club final, right, or an Ireland final, it's a great achievement. But to do it on multiple occasions and then do it in the same year, sure, it's unheard of. I don't know, has it ever been done since? I doubt it.
I don't know. Yeah, again, listeners, I'm sure will give us multiple people who've probably done this over the years, but I can't imagine that the achievement will be matched, particularly doing both in the one season. But like again, he's just a guy who was man the match in pretty much every game that he played along the way. So by all means, especially if you're watching YouTube, stick them into the comments and we'll ask El about some of the other best players that he's played alongside as well. So I look again, just on a final word on Burke and what he brings to it. Like, this is a guy who, he said himself, he wasn't overly happy with how he played in the semi-final. You said the last day that he was kind of, you know, surviving out there as a guy who come back in having missed the summer and having just come back from rehab. I thought he was excellent in the final on Sunday afternoon, though. Like, he was all over the place in that second half in a good way. He wasn't running around like a headless chicken, but it seemed whenever they needed someone to come in to get a hook or to get a block or to bring his physicality, he was there for his team.
Yeah, but see, and that's the thing. I'm happy to say that, Will, because more often than not, we can get, you know, we can get distracted by big scores or by big plays, let's say, when you're on the ball. But when you're off the ball, you know, the hook, the block, the shoulders, you know, the tracking runs, sometimes they don't get seen an awful lot. You know, and it's only when the GPS trackers actually came into play a few years ago, you actually learned with the backup of data, how much ground David Burke was covering. And I remember Damien Joyce telling me before in 17 that he was saying at the time during the game, you know, in that period of the game itself, with the way the model was played, if you were on the ball, I think it was 15 times in a game, you were highly influential, highly influential. And the game against Tipperary in the semi-final, with the same game you mentioned with Joe Kang's Wonder Point, he was on the ball 23 times, you know, as well as covering double figures in kilometres. So that'll tell you the work ethic he has, being able to, you know, work so hard on one side of the ball defensively and then work so hard on the ball and get on it and set up. So, like, it's amazing, to be honest. And, like, I can just picture instances here whereby I can remember, if you remember Shane Maloney point, that Canning, David Burke was the one that shifted, got it out of defence into Joe. Joe hinges the corner, Shane Maloney scores. Then I can picture against Clare back in 18, the two games we played, David Burke was the out ball. Anytime I got a ball, first person look up and see who's free. How he's free, I don't know, was David Burke. And then he'd launch an attack. It's just, he's a great reader. And I think people in Galway would associate Joe Cooney Sr. as being one of the best readers we've ever seen in terms of a game. But David Burke is up there. The way he's able to read the game and find himself in position all the time, you know, is exemplary. So I just think he's one of, like you said earlier on, he's one of Galway's finest ever hurlers.
Yeah, and there he is now with an All-Ireland club medal to go along with being an All-Ireland winning captain at inter-county level as well. That's where we leave pod number one for this week. The Hurling Pod brought to you by Bord Gáis Energy. They are the proud sponsors of the All-Ireland Senior Hurling Championship as well. Skell, thanks a million for now.
God bless.
OTB's The Hurling Pod
with Bord Gáis Energy.
Proud sponsors of the Senior Hurling Championship.